2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
And we are back again with our daily Sherlock Holmes fix. We are all finished with three different collections of short stories, and we decided to start in on a novel. And the genius of the group, Pam Bedour, decided for us that we need to start at the very beginning and go with A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes novel.
And I hadn't read this one in a while. It's such a pleasure to go back to the very beginning. What did you guys think of this one?
This is, I could not ask for a better beginning of a book. Awesome. And in fact, I know why everybody got wrapped into this, because it just reads like, and this is history, and this is part of Sherlock Holmes and Watson. They're real people. Hey, let's set you up. This is a beautiful introduction to both of the characters and the connector who put them in the apartment that they needed to live in.
Yeah, Doyle absolutely lays out the characters very, very well in the very first part of this story. And we know these characters so well after our big study, but here we are getting really good characterizations from the very beginning.
And he's consistent, right? Isn't it impressive that, I mean, we've just been reading in 1904. Here we are back in 1887. And I mean, super consistent representations of Watson and Holmes, don't you think?
I think so too. I mean, what do we get? We get Holmes is an incredibly driven person, self-driven. And in fact, the whole time I'm reading this, I'm going, you know, maybe this is where he gets his money. Does he do all of his scientific research to lease it out, to have patents on it, to sell it to other police departments? I mean, it just seemed today that's how I would write it on how he made his money. And then we get Watson, who describes himself as a lazy guy. So he absolutely loves being with Holmes because he's going to drive him to, like, we're going to go do this. And Holmes is like, okay, let's go.
The relationship is set up so perfectly in this first chapter, for sure. But we get the background of each of the two characters separately, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the very opening, isn't it interesting? The first like page and a half is only about Watson. He's basically telling us like, I'm your narrator and here's who I am. This is the longest bio that we're going to get. This is probably the most spotlight that Watson's going to get in the 60 stories. And so we basically get a bit of a resume from him. He has he's a doctor of medicine from the University of London, which he finished his degree in 1878. He then did an army surgeon certification from Netley. He was an assistant surgeon with the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers, and he was in the 2nd Afghan War. So basically like, bam, bam, bam. Here's who this guy is. He's in his late 20s. And then we get a little bit of his war stories. He was shot in the shoulder, and it's very specific, a shattered bone and a grazed subclavian artery. His life was saved by his orderly. He was sent to a hospital in Peshawar. He had a really rough time there, and he was sent back to England to recover with a 9-month pension. And he has not been very careful with his money, which is where we meet him.
So he's got back to England. He's just trying to find his way in the world. You know, he's basically just exited a war. He's trying to decompress. He decides to hit up a hotel and stay at the hotel, but he eventually, you're right, he finds out that it's just it's draining his finances too quickly. He needs to find another way of living.
And I like how he describes London. He tells us he doesn't have any family or friends in England. So he's, you know, very, very much alone. And he says, under such circumstances, I naturally gravitated to London, that great cesspool into which all the loungers and idlers of the empire are irresistibly drained. Oh,
great writing. That is a great way to describe this city. This is a urban center of the most of Europe, actually, as it comes down to. But the great cesspool. What a great imagery that we have there.
And if you wrote that a little bit later, maybe New York would be our place to be. Or, you know, Tokyo, or if we were writing it maybe in the future, maybe another great city that you could name. But, you know, London is really the place in the world at this time.
That's why we keep Earth time there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he's ill, right? So he's been, and I would just note, like, when we first meet Watson, we have to keep in mind, he's been very, very sick. His recovery from his wound has not gone well. When he first sees his old acquaintance, Stamford, he says, oh, you're as thin as a lath and as brown as a nut. Like, what have you been doing? And now I want to pause here. I know we're reading from 1887, but as I was rereading this, I was reminded how amazing the BBC Sherlock is when it comes to this representation of Watson, bringing Watson into the 21st century. He explicitly has PTSD, which is definitely, you know, they didn't use the term post-traumatic stress disorder in 1887, but there is that sense that he has been shattered by his war experience. And then in the BBC, he uses a cane, which he doesn't need, and he doesn't realize that he's doing a like psychosomatic use of a cane.
Glorious. This the BBC Sherlock is one of the best representations of these characters. And those of you who have not watched that particular series, I really recommend it, especially because it's so short. The BBC just makes stories when they have a story, a beginning, a middle, and an end, not stretching it out like the American Elementary, which is a fine show. But boy, is it stretched out way too thin.
I think the important part is, you know, that Watson has experienced things like many, if not all, military people do, experience things that are not natural. And certainly the mind gets altered from it, and it takes time to process it. You can imagine a person getting back. He was, not only was he injured, he got sick. He arrives back to London. He's just basically trying to find his footing. He's also a young man. So, you know, as you know, I'm kind of wandering around. He hasn't set up a medical practice yet. He hasn't even determined, you know, where he needs to be. He's, as many young people, just trying to find where he's going to set up residence, what he's going to do with his time. And he's basically recovering from an event.
And when he meets this casual acquaintance, Stamford, he is thrilled. This really emphasizes his loneliness, his sense of having no place.
Doesn't he say that Stamford was not like one of his best buddies?
No, not at all. And it seems like the two of them sort of ran into each other on the street and they were both like, hey, you know, someone you don't really know that well, but if you run into them like in Europe, they're like your best friend. It kind of had that feeling to it.
Sure. Sure.
And then Stamford is awesome at like the tantalizing descriptions of Sherlock, right? So this little notion that they're both looking for affordable housing. And Stamford's like, hey, I know someone else who's looking for affordable housing. But he immediately gives like a bunch of details about Sherlock that are so great for the reader and that show up the contradictions of the Sherlock character. You don't know Sherlock Holmes yet. Perhaps you could not care for him. You would not care for him as a constant companion, he says. He is a little queer in his ideas, an enthusiast in some branches of science. As far as I know, he is a decent fellow enough. So he's like, he doesn't want to say anything like super negative about Holmes, but he's not exactly recommending him either. He's not a man that is easy to draw out, though he can be communicative enough when the fancy seizes him.
Is this one of those times where the reader could think maybe that Holmes is on the autism spectrum here, where he's not communicative except for when he is?
I don't necessarily think that. You know, Holmes is a very driven person. You know, think about what you're getting into. I'm going to introduce you to Holmes. You're going to be his roommate. Is Holmes messy? Yeah, he's messy. Does he really care that his chemistry set is out and he's got boiling stuff going on over there and it gets on the table? Not really. He's got some, he's a little eccentric in the sense of where he keeps his tobacco. He's a little eccentric in the drive he has to learn specific knowledge, but not really a big generalist in knowledge. I mean, he's kind of a scientist that's a driven person. And once again, we'll just contrast to Watson, who is, he describes himself as kind of the lazy guy, but you know, he's, he's got his skills. He did what he needed to do. He did his duty to become a doctor and a soldier. So I think that you take this person who does have an iron focus on something, and that's where the oddity, the queerness comes in as people observe him, and then take this generalist, which is Watson, and all of a sudden you've got yourself a good friendship, and Watson being fulfilled through, helping Holmes, achieve what he needs to achieve.
But going back to Steve's question, I mean, I love all of those statements, Chip. I think you've really nailed a lot of exactly why their friendship works. But so would we today actually think of Holmes as being on the autism spectrum? I don't know. Certainly there is much pastiche or fan fiction that's been written with that premise in mind. But certainly his social skills are outliers, right? His approach to social interaction is definitely not the standard of his day. And so he doesn't care if you like him or not, right? And so for the British gentleman, that's kind of a big deal.
Well, he's a charmer. You remember he later on, he convinces some maid to marry him very quickly. And he has this ability to charm people. And you're right in the sense that he could be stuffy's not the right word, arrogant maybe a little bit. Certainly full of himself. He's got plenty of self-confidence. So he knows what he knows and
But I think this is the whole point of Holmes, right? Is that as Stanford is trying to tell Watson a little bit about him, he just keeps coming up short with a bunch of contradictions. And at a certain point, Watson says, just tell me who this guy is. Don't be mealy-mouthed about it. Now, mealy-mouthed, a word we maybe don't use enough, right? And then Stanford responds, it is not easy to express the inexpressible, he answered with a laugh. Mm-hmm. Holmes is too scientific for my tastes. It approaches to cold-bloodedness. Like that. This idea that you can't really capture Holmes, right? Because you can't express the inexpressible, but also the cold-blooded notion, but then he's so passionate at the same time. And he goes on to say, he appears to have a passionate for definite and exact knowledge. So he's that combination of hot and cold, of passion and rationality.
And this is so good in its characterization here. Mm-hmm. Doyle really nails these characters from the beginning. We know Holmes after our weeks and weeks and weeks of study.
35 stories.
But there it is in one sentence. He appears to have a passion for definite and exact knowledge. And Doyle never comes away from this idea of Holmes as this very definite, exact need for knowledge.
Mm-hmm. They go to the university to meet Holmes. And of course, I work at a university. Did you guys notice how different the curriculum is?
It's that idea that I keep trying to stress with my kids, the idea of learn something. Don't be focused on the how or the why. Be focused on the knowledge.
Well, and so Watson's like, so is he like a pre-med student? What's he study? And Stanford's like, I have no idea. Like, clearly, he hasn't done his general education curriculum. He hasn't declared a major. He hasn't met with his advisor to choose courses that would create a coherent whole. He is just at the university studying things. Anatomy and chemistry are his main areas of focus. And it's great when Stanford and Watson enter the chem lab and Holmes exclaims, I found it! I found it! He shouted to my companion, running towards us with a test tube in his hand. I have found a reagent which is precipitated by hemoglobin and by nothing else. Had he discovered a gold mine, greater delight could not have shone upon his features.
Created a test to find traces of blood. They're attributing this to Sherlock Holmes.
I think it's called the Sherlock Holmes test, is what he was going to name it. If I
recall. Well, I'm reading this as a person who, a lot of people go to the university, and what they're learning is that they're being taught how to think like an educated person. And Holmes seems to have jumped that to basically how to use knowledge to derive an answer. And he designed his question and he designed his answer. So he is more advanced than the everyday person, but may not have the general education credits. But you know, not every person has to become a generalist out there. He is a very specific type of learner, a person who is, with his quest for knowledge, he definitely has defined his question to be able to define the answer. And this is the specialized skills that will make him the unique person in the world. And when I was sitting there going through this, I was like, oh, as he describes what's going on, I said, oh, this must be where he gets his income from, because you know, you could easily see how this could be, being a person like this, have it being adopted across the world.
I think he's a Laszlo character. If I say Laszlo, is that shorthand enough? Do you understand that?
No.
Okay. There's a movie called Real Genius, where these college kids have this fantastic ability and they're doing science and they're going to make these amazing discoveries. And then there's a guy that lives in their closet. And that's Laszlo. And eventually we find out that Laszlo doesn't live in the closet. The closet is a elevator to his lab that's underneath the dorm room that they live in. And he's got so much science going on. And they come together to vanquish their enemies. But Laszlo is shorthand in the nerd community for somebody who just has all the answers, is that genius who's been studying at university for who knows how long, but he never goes to class. He doesn't have a major. He's just there, but doing the work.
And doing incredible work.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that the point, ultimately, of the university to come out as a person who has got whatever specialized skill they have to be able to solve whatever they want to do to change the world?
Right there in chapter one of the first book of Sherlock Holmes, we know this character immediately. Holmes's first words to Watson, "How are you?" Which is
with a big
way
handshake
out of character for Holmes, isn't it?
And then he says, "Oh, and you've been in Afghanistan, I perceive." So that is very interesting, right?
So we get this. It's got a tan. Nice. Right. When you see a person with a tan, you immediately say Afghanistan.
No, but so we have the social niceties, and then immediately the like, oh, I am unusual, right? And then I had totally forgotten that in this very first chapter, we see his love of stagecraft, the way he kind of does his whole magician thing. So as he's showing them his discovery, his eyes fairly glittered as he spoke. And he put his hand over his heart and bowed as if to some applauding crowd conjured up by his imagination. How many times are we going to see this through the stories, right? Holmes's flourish as he gives us the solution.
If this was a prequel, I would not buy this, because this is too on the nose. This is so much exactly who these characters are. It's pretty amazing that Doyle nailed these characters down so well in the first chapter of the first book.
Mm-hmm. And just a few sentences. This is not a long chapter.
No.
So basically, you are immediately shotgun through this chapter and you know who our characters are.
And Holmes has a lot of self-knowledge too, right? He turns to Watson. He's like, "Hey, I found these awesome rooms. Let's go check them out tomorrow. Let's share our weaknesses with each other. You should always do that before you move in with someone." And so he just jumps, right? So then he admits his flaws. He says, "I hope you don't mind the strong smell of tobacco." Watson, also a smoker. Perfect. He does do the occasional chemical experiments. "Let me see," he says, "what are my other shortcomings? I get in the dumps at times and don't open my mouth for days on end. You must not think I am sulky when I do that. Just let me alone and I'll soon be right." That's a lot of self-knowledge, right?
No kidding, especially for that time of life. And you know, you gotta think about how he came to that. Do we ever meet Holmes' parents? We meet a brother.
Just Mycroft.
Okay. So, I mean, it's really interesting. You know, he's got to be a young guy. How old do you think they are at this time?
They're in their 20s, in like 26 to 30.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So they've been on their own for a little while. Okay. Well, there you go. You're right. A lot of self-knowledge.
Yeah. Watson lists his flaws as well. He says, I keep a bull pup and I object to rows because my nerves are shaken and I get up all sorts of ungodly hours and I am extremely lazy. I have another set of vices when I'm well, but those are the principal ones at present.
What do you think his vices when well might be?
Brandy.
Who knows? Brandy, fainting. That's right. Brandy and Finn.
And then I love that Holmes jumps in and he's like, oh, wait, do you include violin playing in your category of rows? He asked anxiously. It depends on the player, I answered. A well-played violin is a treat for the gods. A badly played one, oh, that's all right. So this is where we learn that Holmes is actually an excellent violinist. But of course, the violin doesn't appeal as a sound to everyone. And Watson thinks it's music of the gods if it's well done. Perfect match, my friends.
We also get the sentence that I actually didn't put into the show notes. When Watson shakes Holmes's hand for the first time, he notices his amazing strength. All of the character yes. traits are right there in chapter one.
That's right. And the ending is awesome. This is setting up a number of wonderful endings to chapters and stories. So Watson is curious as Watson and Stanford are leaving the lab. He's like, how did Holmes know that I had been to Afghanistan?
Yeah, he said, how the deuce, which is one of those replacement words that we hear all the time when we don't want to say naughty words. Sometimes we use replacement exclamations. And this is the second one that Watson gives us. He is the first character in Doyle to say, by Jove, in this chapter. And he uses the replacement words, how the deuce. How the deuce did he know that I came from Afghanistan? Blah, 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 blah.
Two words that you can use as your exclamations and no one will say anything about it, right?
That's right.
How the deuce could you not do that? By Jove.
Stanford replies, a good many people have wanted to know how he finds things out.
Oh, a mystery, is it? I cried, rubbing my hands. This is very piquant. I am much obliged to you for bringing us together. The proper study of mankind is man, you know. You must study him, then, Stanford said as he bade me goodbye. You'll find him a knotty problem, though. I'll wager he learns more about you than you about him. Goodbye. Goodbye, I answered, and strolled on to my hotel, considerably interested in my new acquaintance. End of chapter one. Now, there's so many things to like about this little exchange. First of all, oh yeah, Holmes is going to learn a lot more about Watson than Watson is going to learn about Holmes, right?
Oh, absolutely. We know that, but the readers of this original story might not know. They might be studying Sherlock Holmes here, and probably this book studies Sherlock Holmes more than the subsequent short stories. Uh-huh.
Well, as a writer, or as a person who is thinking or considering being a writer, I could not ask for more in a first chapter. This one was, it was like beat for beat. You're getting so much good information. It wasn't a dump of information. And it just felt like you're going to know these characters. And having my background of reading all these short stories beforehand, I was like, of course we're going to love this book. Because, I mean, Doyle, really, this is a masterful chapter.
Including a philosophical poem from Alexander Pope.
So when Watson just said there at the end, the proper study of mankind is man. So that actually comes from Pope's An Essay on Man, which is a poem, not an essay. And the lines around it are, know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. So this notion of this whole poem is really about the changing relationship between science and theology in the late, he's actually writing years ago, but this, how do we know God? The only thing we can really do is study humans, and that is how we come to God. So I think that by recapping this poem from like over a century earlier, Doyle is setting up the epistemological questions he has about how do we know, like, what is the place of science? What is the place of religion? What is the place of experience, observation? What is rationality? What is knowledge? and what are different tensions in the late Victorian period as people are trying to figure this stuff out.
And that's what Mary Shelley did by publishing Frankenstein. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Exactly. No, and I mean, this is really engaging in those exact same questions that Shelley was so interested in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is so good. Pam, thank you for telling us what story to read.
Thank you.
Because this is the right story to read.
Yeah.
Reading it out of order has worked out so well for us because we get to read this with that perspective from all of those other short stories where we have these characters so well developed by the end. But I said it 7 times already. I'm going to say it an 8th time. These characters are perfect from the get-go of this story. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yay, it's going to be fun. 14 chapters. Woo.
Awesome. 2 more weeks. 2 more weeks of this. Then we can move on to more Sherlock Holmes, because there's always more Sherlock Holmes. This is wonderful. I hope everybody out there is listening and enjoying it as much as we are. Hopefully you're reading this along with us, especially this first chapter of A Study in Scarlet. We'll come back tomorrow and talk about chapter 2. We would love to hear from you. What are you doing? How are you? Are you okay? We would love to hear your feedback on Sherlock Holmes and on our silly conversations. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes on all the social medias for all that feedback. And remember, we have our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sherlock.toomuchscrolling.com, where you can find all of our fun conversations about all of these short stories and novels that we've covered for the last 56 days or whatever it is. It's been a long time. So tune in tomorrow. We will get to chapter 2 and see more of this. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Trip Hassan Flum.
And I'm Pam Bedor.
We'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about, what I want to think for, what I want to